Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is L.A. Steele, and happy to be with you tonight. I wasn't really quite sure. I had a number of things in mind that I wanted to do tonight, and sometimes they get all log jammed, and I just opened the chat room, so if anybody just joined me, please, you're welcome to join in. Send your comments to me, or whatever you want. I wasn't sure what to read tonight. I wanted to read, to continue with some of these lectures by Manly Hall, but because I don't know why I'm being driven to them, and I've always seemed to follow my instincts or intuition when I choose what I want to read on these Thursday nights, and just like I do, of course, any time when I, you know, pick out news articles or whatever we do. But this particular essay, I started it, and I got through probably half of it, I believe, and I was unable to finish it because of time problems and restraints. I just wasn't able to jump back into this one. In fact, what I did is I jumped over. There was a few more that were extremely interesting as well, but I may get into in the next few shows. Thursday night shows. I don't know why I can't do more of these. It takes me a week to or 3 or 4 days to digest one of these lectures, and so if a lot of it seems to go over your head, or maybe it's over my head, go back to it. I'm trying to read it in the way that it's written. I may throw in a comment if I'm overwhelmed with something, or if I feel like I need to clarify something. I decided tonight I would read the Wonders of Ocean. This is The Sea as a Symbol of Cosmic Consciousness. And I really liked this lecture. I liked the tone of it, but I liked what it said, and it opened my eyes to a number of, to information that I wasn't aware of. And he wrote this in 1966, just to be here. It's Lecture 93, Wonders of Ocean. This is by Manly P. Hall. We have always been deeply influenced by the mysteries of the sea. And from the beginning of man's experience, he intuitively recognized his dependency upon the ocean for his own existence. Long before modern science began to suspect that life on this planet originated in water, ancient peoples had accepted this as an absolute fact. Nearly all the terms we associate with the beginning of life, either individual or collective, have to do with water. The mystery of this great world of depth, motion, substance, and life that we have yet to explore. We know that such terms as Mary, Mother, Martha, and Marie all are derived from water, and so was the name Isis, the mother goddess of Egypt. So these words all meant water, or all mean water, which is the origin of our birth. There was also the belief that beneath the ocean are mysteries relating to the antiquity of our world, and lost continents lie hidden there, the ancient and forgotten Lumeria, Atlantis, and Gondwana land. And some early peoples believed that the motion of water was due to the restlessness of souls belonging to these submerged worlds, and that the salt of the ocean came from the tears of those who had lived and died in suffering over millions of years. Thus many unusual beliefs developed around the sea, and it has its own legendary and mythology, and its own strange psychic power in the life of the individual. In the old days when men were made of iron and ships were made of wood, the sailor expected to go to rest in the ocean. He did not like the thought of being buried on land. He had lived on the sea, and he knew it, and he feared it, and he loved it, all at the same time. Man, watching the ocean, has observed its moods, and at a very early time it seemed impossible that these moods should be without some rational factor behind them. He watched the sea whipped into storm by the wind, and he saw the deep currents of it, and endless, restless tides. He heard the sound of the sea, a mournful, forlorn sound rising from the deep, and there was a relentlessness, a remorselessness about it. And by these very qualities, it symbolized eternal victory over all conditioned existence. Western man, because his nature was so locked in the struggle for survival, had a certain dread of this great water which could so easily swallow him up, destroy him utterly, wreck his ambitions, as storm wrecked the Spanish Armada. In the early days of the Western world, the sea represented a link between distant places, for when travel upon land was too dangerous or too difficult, men skirted its shore in boats. They passed through the Pillars of Hercules out to the Mediterranean Sea to explore the coast and the northern parts of Europe. The Phoenicians battered with the Druids and the Celts, and a great merchandising arose from traders along the sea. But as these traders grew rich, another problem developed. Pirates waited on the seas to capture the great prizes of treasures laden vessels that plied the waters from port to port. The sea has always been a challenge, and Western man, looking always for ways to explain himself, finally accepted the sea as a symbol of his own imagination. Placing it under the leadership of the lunar power, he saw it as the great mirror of imaginings, and compared its inconsistencies to the moods and emotions of men. Always keenly aware of surfaces and of the inconsistencies with which his life could be afflicted, he likened the sea to the journey of life, with all his hazards, with all its hazards. And each human being was another Odysseus returning from the Trojan War to make the strange and difficult journey under the curse of Poseidon, Lord of the Sea. On the other side of the world, Eastern man became, because he never declared war with nature, never set himself up as the conqueror of mountains or waters, developed a rather different attitude toward the ocean. In Eastern philosophy, the sea is almost always a highly benevolent symbol. Its surfaces, its storms and winds and clouds were merely phases moving the visible part of a great invisible silence. Therefore, instead of associating it with imagination and with the moods of human desires and passions, the Easterner associated it with consciousness, the great deep part of life. By the same analogy, he was able to show how the surface of consciousness, the part we recognize or make use of, is frequently swept by storms. That man, upon the surface of his nature, is agelessly restless, and always seems to be stirred by some force apart from himself. No matter which way the winds of policy or religion or industry or economics may blow, the surface of man's ocean will be whipped into a strange storm. The waves will grow high. There will be much wreckage along the way. There is always wreckage where men struggle against the irresistible forces of existence. Let me repeat that. There is always wreckage where men struggle against the irresistible forces of existence. But beneath and behind all this, the Eastern mind perceives the symbol of silence. It is a symbol of the infinite potentiality of the human unconscious, and it seems, in the terms of modern researches in psychology, that this might be a very well-taken attitude. And Dr. Young, in one of his writings, describes how certain conditions can cause submerged attitudes to float slowly but inevitably into the surface of the ocean of man's consciousness, that what we call psychic pressure seems to arise in the deep and come up until some strange phantom, much as what the Oriental people sometimes called the sea monk, a ghost that dwelt in the ocean and was said to arise and frighten mariners. Yet this ghost was merely a mirage, an image. The sea people believe the ocean to be full of mirages, of fantasies, and they maintain that this makes it all the more like the unconscious life of man. It has been described in a thousand ways, burdened with countless explanations, and to it is attributed an endless diversity of phenomena. Yet the nature of the subconscious, the unconscious, and the ocean, these still remain comparatively unknown. In the Eastern-like thinking, there was also the belief that as man began in an ocean, perhaps as a little one-celled organism, as he gradually crawled out of that ocean to become a creature of the land, so in the end, in the infinite way of things, man would return to the great sea of consciousness and perhaps to the physical sea around us. If through his own bad thinking or destructive mechanisms, he should destroy the world and the land to which he belongs. If he does, ultimately life will again come out of the sea, for this is the mysterious link to the planet between universal life and the endless sequence of conditioned appearances, which we call forms and bodies and organisms. In any event, according to the Eastern view, man must return to that of which the sea is a symbol, and that is eternity. Time must ultimately be absorbed into that which transcends time. In Buddhism, the sea is a symbol of nirvana, which is the ultimate disappearance of things from condition to return to the eternity from which they came. Thus the sea is a symbol of the one universal Atman, the one infinite consciousness that sustains all things. For if it were not for the ocean, nothing would live upon the land. The infinite rises the symbol of our greatest need on earth, water. And this is indeed the water of everlastingness, and is a proper symbol of that spiritual water referred to by Jesus when he said that those who drink of the water of life will not thirst again. And all these analogies to the ocean and to the sea are very interesting and meaningful to us, and may cause us to consider the sea within us as well as the sea around us, to observe something of the mystery of ocean as it develops in our own psychology. Some will say, and perhaps justly, that this whole psychology arose from the fact that man, in some mysterious way, interrupted the vast surface and depth of the sea in terms of his own experience, and thus created his own symbolic insight and indoctrinated himself with the symbolism which he himself had devised. One thing is certain. In studying the concepts of man's life, his emotions, his thoughts, and his existence in total, we must come to the final conclusion, I think, that man is as though in a little ship on the surface of an ocean. The human being has a body with a personality which permits him experience of traveling the sea of life. He belongs to the sea, yet has created a shell by which his own individuality is perceived while he floats across this ocean. Because he has this little ship of individuality, because he has created a separateness in himself, he can explore, go to all kinds of distant places. But as one Eastern philosopher observed long ago, if he explores, what does he explore? If he travels to the most distant places, where does he go? Actually, he explores and he travels merely because of the shell he himself has created. If it were not for this shell, if he were again infinite life, he would be everywhere. He would be able, but the very nature of his own consciousness, to know all that he seeks to explore. His whole life, therefore, exists largely because he has separated himself from the infinite, and in so doing has become a finite being who must then dedicate his efforts for ages, for millenniums, to the search for his own infinite nature. And the sea within us is represented perhaps by a surface, and this surface is the conscious mind of the individual. It is the surface that enables us to dwell in the immediacy of ourselves. It is the surface by which we meet each day, making a living and develop all the interests and activities that constitute life as we know it. It is because of this surface that we can share with others and feel that we inhabit a universe of surfaces. By the surface of ourselves, we meet, except symbolically, the surface of all other living things. We accept the surface of our neighbor, his appearances, prosperity, the symbols of his worldly goods. We accept the surface of happiness, these things that everyone seems to do, and then everyone seems to be happy. As we travel, we accept the surfaces of national boundaries, and we recognize the surfaces of time. We are struggling with these things constantly. With rapid transportation, we are cutting down the surface intervals of time. So in our conquest of distance, we have victory over another surface of things. But we are forever looking for surface refinement. We wish to have the surface presentable to other people. We like to be well-dressed, and we adorn this surface in countless ways to add to personal attractiveness. We are like the famous sign of the paint company: save the surface and you save all. That's funny. Actually, however, man living in consciousness of surface gradually comes to certain conclusions. He cannot deny that in other things there is some things under the surface. There are values which he cannot see directly, cannot know actually and factually with his sensory perceptions. Yet he is convinced they exist. He looks at a great business house and realizes that it is not only a structure. In some mysterious way, it is a policy. It is an activity. There has to be something behind the surface. He looks at his neighbor, and he knows there is something more to this neighbor than surface. There are attitudes, and he wonders what his neighbor thinks of him. Everywhere, he finally comes to the conclusion that there is not only what he sees, but something behind it, beneath it. For it is his nature to think of things as beneath surfaces. Our experience with this breathlessness has been one of our problems since the dawn of time. The moment we begin to wonder about what we cannot see, we seem to head directly into neurosis. If our neighbor is sitting quietly with a kind of strange look on his face, we know immediately he does not like us. There is nothing he can be thinking about but us. If two people standing on the street are engaged in a very intimate conversation with an overtone of secrecy about it, we know they are gossiping about us. Always, the unknown is something that is a little frightening. We are afraid of what is beneath appearances. That's true. I mean, we all are. We all get paranoid, but not that much. I mean, not that badly paranoid. But a lot of people think, well, gee, they're talking about me, but they're really not. And I get that all the time because of I have exposure. And one of the first things you do when you're on the air, when I first got on television, this is 10 years ago, and then when you produce a show and you're on, and suddenly you get thousands and thousands of people watching you, and then you kind of like are waiting for some kind of feedback, and you do and you don't. Sometimes you do, you get a little bit, but you're expecting. Sometimes you're expecting a huge feedback, and there really isn't any huge feedback. It's just like people go, oh, I didn't hear it. No, I don't know. You know, but there are a few people that probably picked it up, or some people watched it. And you might, if you're very lucky, you might get back a response. Interestingly enough, if you, I read when I first got into this business, into television and radio, I found out that I read something that for every one email that you receive that you can get back, or one letter or one response that you get, is equal to about 10,000 listeners or viewers in the audience. So they're saying that 1 out of 10,000 will respond to you. Now, if that's the case, 1 out of 10 actually, you know, going to the thing of contacting you, your show, or contacting me personally for thanking me for the show, there's 10,000 people out there, and so if you get 2, that's 20,000, 3, you know, and that's based on marketing statistics. It's not that I didn't make that up, you know, today it may be less because there's so much more emailing, but quite frankly, I'm not, you know, I shouldn't say this at all, but I'm really not one who emails other shows. I think I've only done that once or twice. I've ever written a letter to a show that I really, really enjoyed listening to, but I'm not one that's really goes all out, and part of it is because if it's a regular radio show, I might not have heard a lot of the programming. I might have heard just one, or now I don't know the person well enough to criticize what he does, or where he comes from. So it's like I'm reluctant to send emails of praise or criticism to anyone before I've really kind of followed them for a while or had interest or kept interest. Then you become kind of involved with the person, and you know, you listen to them. So that's how you build up an audience, and that's how we gain audiences. And it's very difficult because you can either you can turn off people just as fast as you can interest them, and by your topic or the way you are or what you say, but. Overall, we've stayed on the air, and FM and radio for 6 years. I've been on television for 10, and we still have a very good audience. A lot of people look forward to seeing our program or tuning us in each week, and we're very, very grateful. I'm very grateful for that. It means that we may have something to say. So let me continue this reading here tonight. I got a little carried away, but I wanted to. One of the reasons that I find this what I liked about this lecture that we're on now, it's The Wonders of Ocean, is when I got into reading it, I became somewhat overwhelmed by the vastness of the image of the ocean, and how ocean is consciousness. I mean, just getting into this lecture, it brings you further and further and further into the vision of the ocean as our birth, as our origin, and as our our consciousness. It's our consciousness. It's the ocean is God, you know. So it's like really bizarre, and that's why I enjoyed reading this so much. But it does. It kind of makes you a little. It makes me a little loopy, in that I have a tendency to visualize some of these images, and they're magnificent. He was quite the writer. He was a fascinating writer, and I do believe some of this work was channeled. There's no question his work is. Inspired. So, you know, as we read it, you're looking at different layers of symbolism and knowledge that, you know, it takes some time to read this. But the effort of primitive man to explore the sea was always limited to his inability to live in that region. In the old days, before artificial and scientific devices were invented, the maximum of his endurance underwater was 2 or 3 minutes. He was amazed to find other creatures that apparently did not have to breathe air, or if they did not breathe so frequently. And in the sea, men, were therefore capable of completely satisfactory existence on both the land and in the sea. Man trying psychologically to enter into his own inner life, finds himself in a world in which his mind and emotions can no longer breathe. He finds that if he remains in it too long, it seems as though he will never escape from it again. So he does everything he can to prevent the disorientation of his surface life. Eastern philosophy points out that it is quite true that man cannot, and at this time, live in the ocean. It is a world belonging to another kind of life. But he does not need to fear ocean. He only has to recognize it for what it is, and build it into his psychology of life in a factual and practical way. If he takes advantage of it in a normal and proper manner, using it for transportation or to gain water power for various projects that he wishes to advance, but never abusing it or exploiting it, then he will no longer find it an enemy. Always it is an enemy because of something that man does. It is an enemy because of something that man does. He, in some way, forces the situation and creates an enemy out of what might be a helpful friend. In studying man's subconscious, psychology today is quite certain that this mysterious region is inhibited by forms of life that have no correspondence in our visible world, as well as creatures of which we occasionally have some visible evidence. It is like the fable of the sea serpent that is kept alive from generation to generation because approximately every 20 years somebody sees one. Yet for the most part, the world does not believe in the existence of such monsters. In any event, in the subconscious of man, there are all kinds of mysterious pressures. If we look in any of the great aquariums, we will see an assortment of fantastic life that is almost unbelievable. The forms by means of which nature has adapted the creatures of the undersea to the world in which they live transcend imagination. Each is useful and necessary. Each is part of the defensive process of the survival of creatures. But far down in the depths of the ocean, there are actually colors more brilliant than the wings of a butterfly. There are creatures that have their own private electrical systems far below the sea. We are amazed at the forms which all these types of creatures take. Philosophically, we can ask ourselves, what are the forms and shapes and the contents of our own subconscious lives? If we could see thought and emotions, what would we look like? What would they look like? Mystics and mediums and psychics who have claimed to have seen these things report a great diversity of astonishing forms, and it is quite conceivable that if we could actually see the energy vortices that are set up within our own consciousness, we would find that they are not much more attractive than some of the monstrosities of the great deep. We would probably see some creatures that would make the octopus look very handsome. What does our own possessiveness, what does the selfishness, self-centered person look like as a psychic being, not a physical one? If he has lived all his life to grab, perhaps he has more arms than the octopus if we could see him physically. And perhaps if he spread poison to achieve his own purposes in this world, he is no more attractive physically than the stingray or some creature of the deep that captures its prey by destroying it. We do not know the real shape of these invisible entities, but our medieval ancestors have quite a time trying to imagine them. And artists of the 15th and 16th centuries like to depict the temptations of St. Anthony, for example, by filling the air around him with an assortment of demons, great monks, great mosquitoes with human heads, and all kinds of composite monsters, strange bug-like things, winged horns, and everything you could think of. Yet most of the creatures that are shown in these old engravings can be seen today with a microscope, and things almost as fantastic, and some much more fantastic, exist in the ocean, and their grotesqueness is merely adaptation to environment. And if they should come forth upon the land and see what exists here, they would consider it equally grotesque. If there are strange forms, mysterious plaguing things that rise and develop and grow in the subconscious life of man, and we can ask how man happened to invent such an idea of subconscious. There is no question in the world that it is in the world that it all began on the outside, that man experienced various things that he could not understand, gradually developed fantastic explanations because no other explanation was available. Knowledge, instead of solving the problem and taking away the fantasy, merely enlarged it, because everything man learned only taught him how much more he did not know. And learning, instead of solving everything, has ended in the greatest question mark of all. That's the truth. You know, it's like that's what the whole Adam and Eve story is about. You know, just a total tree of knowledge. You know, they were satisfied. These people were satisfied with their lives. You know, perfectly satisfied until they ate of the tree of knowledge, and then they were never satisfied. And that's our curse. That's my curse. I mean, I'm always hungry for knowledge, always looking for it, I was looking for wisdom or knowledge, and it's trying to discern what's real and what's not. I'm just trying to find where I left off here. All these problems remain the mysteries they always were, because man is a mysterious creature existing in the midst of a mystery. He is strangely frightened and disturbed, but he does not really know how to put his universe in order. If we go still further into the inner life of man, we may find that it has another likeness to the ocean. If we could have some form of clairvoyant sight by which we could pierce the surface of the water and see down into the great region below, we would discover that it was a graveyard of ancient ships. And even today, they are mysterious accidents in which airplanes or ships carry their living cargo to an eternal rest into the darkness of ocean's depths. The opinion is now that most of this wreckage never reaches the bottom, but floats in a stratum somewhere. It goes so deep and no deeper until, or unless the sea is shallow enough for it to reach the bottom and floats forever in some middle distance. This again carries a psychological parallel. In the subconscious of man, there is a strange wreckage that never comes to the top and never seems to quite reach the bottom of things. Perhaps this represents the way in which our subconscious is gradually filled up, and also the source of the strange ghostly pressures that come from it. It is loaded with the wreckage of our own attitudes, emotions, thoughts, and actions. Here, then, is the subconscious of man. In the subconscious of man is the graveyard of his own experiences, escapades, promises, everything that he has attempted and found beyond his strength, and also the wreckage of things he has attained and found they were not worth attaining. So there is a strange rubbish in his subconscious, and it is as though into it, as into the ocean, flows all the refuse of the world. Now, ocean is also the great purifier. Everywhere on the surface of the earth, the refuse of human life and of nature flows finally into the mystery of the coast of the ocean. But in the great salt body of the sea, a wonderful process of purification is forever taking place. And even in this process of purification, the sea does not sterilize itself. It is full of life at all times. This again takes us back to the consciousness itself, which must receive all the refuse of our thinking. Consciousness must accept all our disappointments, disillusionments, and despair. It must receive the cry of pain in the night and struggle to live in those last mysterious transitional processes by which life ends, or those mysteries of birth by which life has its blessed beginnings. And consciousness must absorb, transmute, and purify all the manifestations of itself. The Easterner believes that consciousness can do this because it is deeper and greater than all the manifestations that arise from it. As it gives birth to love and hate, as it creates hope and fear, so in the end of things, consciousness takes them all into itself and redeems them. Thus, consciousness becomes, like the ocean, the great purifier of life. And the Easterner would say that when we find the reality and the purposes of the law, then consciousness has redeemed the uncertainties that were cast upon its surface. We remember the wisdom of the great Taoist philosopher Lao Tzu, who likened the whole cycle of existence to the cycle of water. For water, rising from the sea, is drawn into the air to form clouds. And these clouds drift over the mountains, and there the rain falls. The rain falling into the streams and rivulets come down the mountains to form the rivers. Cities and towns receive their water from the great stream, and the rivers make fertile the earth where the farmers plant his rice. But the river always goes back into the sea. Then, after a course of proper time, the light and heat draw the water into the sky, clouds form, and the great cycle is repeated. This is life. One condition in eternal motion, one substance picked up and carried away from itself, only to return inevitably to itself again. Life is a process of the flowing of a river through a world of experience, where the farms and cities and meadows exist. Life is forever a cycle from the sea to the sea. From the sea to the sea, or what we may call from the unseen to the unseen, passing for a little sea, or what we may call from the unseen to the passing for a little time through the sphere of visibility. So again, we have the symbolism of ocean. We are reminded again of the Buddhist concept of nirvana as the symbol of the infinite. And Arnold, in his beautiful poem, gives us a formula for nirvana when he says, O mani padsmi hum. The daybreak comes and the dewdrop slips back into the shining sea. This is nirvana, and the return of the divided to the total, and the return of the little drop of water to the sea, the return of all the great cycle that Lao Tse described. For the little drop of water, it is a drop of rain that has just picked out of the sea by the sun. So in the Buddhist philosophy, the sea does not represent the awful depths in which men die, but the wonderful ocean in which finally we achieve perfect immortality. To these people, there is only one ultimate that is worthy of this state of man, and that is unity with life itself. Western man expresses his thought when he says that all growth, all suffering, and all living lead back to God. For God, as Western man's symbol of the infinite, is that totality, that completeness, that all sufficientness towards which we all strangely and wonderfully fully long, even though we do not understand what it is. You can say that again. And wherever. Somewhere beyond condition is that which transcends condition. Beyond pain is peace. Beyond all the uncertainties of things are the tranquilities of principles. Beyond life, as we know it, is the serenity of the infinite. So in Buddhism, the ocean represents its total serenity, consciousness no longer conditioned by any vanity or delusion by which we disturb the surface of our living. To achieve this inner calm, man must master the mastery of ocean, which for himself is the mystery of commotion. I'm going to skip some of this because I find some of his meters to be monotonous, you know, in the reading, and he can get that way at times. And I have to skip over it because I don't know. This. There's just not, something's telling me not to continue this tonight. I pick up on something else. kind of at a loss. I should further pursue this, but I don't feel like I can. I don't know why sometimes. It's just something, intuition of some sort, tells me not to bother. Not to bother. Somewhere beyond condition is that which transcends condition. Beyond pain is peace. Beyond all the uncertainties of things are the tranquilities of principles. I know I read this before, but I just had to read it again. Beyond life as we know it is the serenity of the infinite. So in Buddhism, the ocean represents this total serenity. Consciousness no longer conditioned by any vanity or delusion by which we disturb the surface of our living. To achieve this inner calm, man must master the mystery of ocean, which for him is the mystery of commotion and the process of constant change, the motion of the tireless sea forever struggling, constantly moving, as though some great surging power would not let it rest. In Christian mysticism, the Master Jesus, walking upon the stormy water, said, "Be still," and the seas were quieted. And in the Eastern approach to life, also the individual controls his stormy emotions and achieves this feeling of great quietude, suddenly senses that the storm of life is not necessary. It is not an actual reality. It is something that he permits and not something that is forced upon him by powers or conditions beyond his control. The Easterner, therefore, seeks to end forever this great upsurging of the secret courses and currents of motion in himself. He seeks to free himself from the storms in the air that may disturb the quiet surface of the deep. Man realizes that one of the great dangers of the sea is communicated to it from something else, the air. The sea itself has its currents and tides, but they are deep and for the most part strangely calm. But the sea swept by the winds become a terrible thing, breaking upon the shore, destroying the world men have tried to build, carrying away homes and inundating great areas of earth. This is the tragedy of it all, the tragedy of the ocean and the hurricane. But the wise men said, man is different from the ocean in one particular. He can control the hurricanes, because the only hurricanes that can really disturb his ocean are always in himself. And perhaps they are stimulated or justified by outer circumstances. But the great storms are the ones that men permit to occur, not the storms that must happen. So the individual tries to detach himself from the stress and strain of outward pressures. He tries to quiet his nature. He tries to quell the storm with the divine power in himself, saying to the waves, "Be still." And he knows in himself that he has the power to cause them to obey, for that power is the great spirit of eternal peace in his own soul, and the peace which he knows he also possesses, and which is his strength against the storm. The quiet meditative way of life gradually liberates man from the hurricanes, tornadoes, and gales that would overwhelm otherwise whip his thoughts and emotions into frenzies. He finds that if he can live a gentle, quiet life, he is not impoverished. He is not a lonely, deserted creature because he has a certain measure of self-control. And in his quietude, he begins to discover the wonders of himself, for he comes in contact with the world beneath the surface of things. He learns that by going into himself, he becomes a citizen of another dimension of existence. He is able to live in the realm of consciousness if he knows within himself that he can. And he will not be drowned in its depths, but will find the perfect solution to his own need. To sum up the phrase of our subject, then, we can say that the sea, in its depth, became the symbol of eternity, reality, and peace. But the surface of the sea symbolized impermanence, but the confusion and ignorance of the mortal storm of existence. All the confusion and ignorance of the mortal storm of existence. There is another interesting symbolism that has descended to us with the mystical tradition of old times, particularly in the tradition called Illuminism, which had a considerable revival in Germany in the 18th century under Weishaupt, which is the Illuminati. And the Illuminism, there is the story of a diver who goes down under the sea in search of a pearl of great price. In this case, the sea becomes the symbol of embodiment, the individual taking upon himself a form and in being immersed in the mystery of generation. So, the Greeks declared that generation was an ocean into which souls fell and drowned. They did not truly die, but they were obscured in their inner natures, that they were no longer able to be aware of their own existence. This sea was a strange realm of psychic death, in which spiritual life ceased to have authority over the actions of living things. The sea was therefore the abode of the pearl, or the flaming jewel of the Eastern philosophical system. And the pearl of great price represented man's final regeneration of himself. It was the human experience of the infinite wisdom of things by which man became capable of the complete conscious dedication to truth. It was therefore the wonderful gem that was hidden in the palace of the sea king, guarded by a terrible dragon. Everywhere and always, it symbolizes the achievement of truth, the full understanding of life, and the perfection of the soul gem within the individual. This is the priceless jewel of immortality, for he who has possessed the full insight of things cannot die, though his body may fatigue and depart. Immortality is not of the flesh, but of the consciousness within the body. We've got about 4 minutes left of the show. We know that in antiquity, ocean was a symbol of generation. It was also the symbol of imagination, of fantasy. It represented the soul's strange, wonderful emotionalization of life, inevitably in the course of the moon. For the human soul is the prisoner of the moon. In this also there is an interesting thought, that perhaps it is not in the oceans of mind that the secret is hidden, but in the ocean of the heart, that in some wonderful way, emotion, rather than thought, is the actual seal, or rather, is the actual seeing here is the ocean is everything. It's a purifier. It's our consciousness, and it does exactly what our consciousness does. And the ocean in this becomes an allegory. It becomes a metaphor for our own consciousness and where we came from and how we got there and how we're where we are now. And it all relates to this remarkable ability for us to continue to create and learn, become more knowledgeable and understand the patterns, understand how things are going, and know that in 2012, maybe, and I'm not fully convinced of this yet, but this is where I'm hoping, is that in 2012 we'll experience that the extinction of time and space. There will no longer be any time or space. What that means to us, I do not know. But this is what everything is leading up to, and how we are capable as a species of regenerating and growing, expanding in our knowledge. And and tomorrow night we're going to, with George Dixon, we're going to discuss unity consciousness. I think we'll enjoy that. And I hope you tune into us. I see, Kirtik, thank you. Thank you for joining me, and I'm glad you enjoyed that. I wasn't really sure where I was going with that, but I think the ocean, just like our lives, are just are holograms for the great energy, and we just keep expanding and into an infinite, into infinity, which is our goal. That's where we want to go. So I want to thank you for joining me tonight, Sharon, and thank you, everybody else, and have a pleasant evening. And hope you join us tomorrow night. Good night.